Session number 223-69-01.
General Buckland, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
At 121 St James's Court, near Buckingham Palace.
Which year was this?
1920.
Can you tell me, first of all, how you came to be in the army?
Well, it was quite obvious in 1939 when I left Winchester that there was likely to be a war. And so I joined the supplementary reserve of officers of the Rifle Brigade, because the Rifle Brigade was very much allied to Winchester. When the war started, I was coming back from a public schools tour to Canada, and war was declared when we were halfway back. So I rang up as soon as I got home the Rifle Brigade depot and said, how soon do I join? And they said, we don't want you yet, you're much too young, go to Oxford for a year. So I went to Oxford and I sat my first exam at the time of Dunkirk, and needless to say I didn't do at all well. But I was so upset about all this and the fact that we'd been thrown out of France that I went to the adjutant of the Oxford Training Corps, where incidentally I got my Cert B, and said to him, how do I get in the army before we're all put in a concentration camp? Now I'm sure the good Lord looks after you, because the week before I went to see him, the adjutant of the OTC had been a cavalryman in the 13th, 18th, and a Coldstreamer arrived to replace him, called John Bailey, who I got to know extremely well. So he said, would you like to join the Coldstream? And I said, yes, please, having not really heard the first thing about them. Anybody to get me in now? So he arranged an interview. I went up to London and was interviewed by the regimental lieutenant colonel, accepted, and within a month I was at the Guards Depot. I was very pleased I went to the Guards Depot, because if I had joined up 2 months or so afterwards, I would have been excused having to go to the depot and gone straight to an octo, because of the fact that people who'd got their Cert B were excused sort of other rank training. But I find my 8 weeks at the Guards Depot extremely useful and extremely tough, but obviously stood you in good stead afterwards, because you knew the cries.
In what way tough?
Well, I mean, you got up at 6 o'clock, had to rush off and shave at once, you had breakfast about 7:15, you were on parade by 9, having done all the things you had to do, folded up all your blankets and everything, absolutely plumb square. You slept on 3 hard boards on 2 trestles, with on top of it a straw palliat, and no sheets at all, just 4 blankets. Fortunately, it was in the summer. You then worked all day, as it were. The food was appalling. You worked all day till 4 o'clock. Then you had tea. Then you had an hour and a half where you sat on your bed in silence, and you cleaned your kit and your boots until you could see your face in them and all that, while the squad instructor, who was a lance sergeant, taught you, among other things, regimental history. At 7:15, for the first time, you had some free time, and you went off to the naffy to get some food. You were paid 2 bob a day, which while I was at the depot went up to 0.5 crown a day, so everybody thought that was absolutely splendid. You drew 10 shillings a week by way of pay, to help to pay for the food in the naffy. The rest they kept either as a credit or by way of stoppages. You paid sixpence a week haircut. You paid sixpence a week into a fund anyway, for barrack damages, etc. By the time you'd had your food at the naffy, etc., and got back, it was probably about 9, and you were so knackered that all you wanted to do was to go to bed and go to sleep. Our training there was interrupted somewhat because the Germans began to bomb the south of England. And the commandant of the depot was quite convinced that the guard's depot was a major target. In fact, it wasn't at all what they were trying to hit. It was Kenley Airfield, which was next door almost. So we got some of the near misses, and there was one bad bomb which killed a lot of Welsh guardsmen in a barrack block. But we spent far too much time in the air raid shelters, etc., as opposed to getting on with our training. I then went to Sandhurst for what was meant to be a four-month course. In fact, they cut it short to 3, and I got my commission in the Coldstream at the end of December 1940. I then went to the training battalion at Pirbright, where, rightly or wrongly, they were treating the whole thing rather like a sausage machine. And one didn't get to know the men, which I thought was a bad thing, but you obviously knew your particular week by heart. Unfortunately, my week consisted on 2 days of long route marches, so I was extremely fit. But didn't really get to know the men at all, and I think, obviously, since that time, they've changed it all. In April 41, I was posted to the holding battalion, where I immediately went with number one company down to guard Winston Churchill, in fact, at Chequers, which was a fascinating 2 months.
What was fascinating about it?
Well, you trained in the area on Mondays to Fridays. Winston would arrive down most weekends on Friday evening with all the good and the great, and they used to have lengthy discussions and God knows what else. And we had, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was something like 14 sentry posts all around the place and some anti-aircraft guns. Because the powers that be were quite convinced that, that the Germans were going to be after him. And on two occasions, I was invited to go and have a meal, and it was fascinating to hear these great men talking away. You know, and one was the fly on the wall.
You remember any details of the conversation?
I remember, well, one time I was there because when the Bismarck was sunk, it was just before we left, and being a great parliamentarian, I remember Winston after the Bismarck was sunk, Hood was sunk to start with, and he sat down in a chair and blubbed like a small boy almost. He was so upset about it, tears rolling down his cheeks. And When we sank the Bismarck, he said, "Send for my motor car. I will announce this to the House within the hour." Whereas Mr. Blair and co. would promptly go and speak to the press about it. He wasn't interested in anybody pressman at all. The House was the only place to announce things of import. I remember one lunch party I was at. He, once the food was over, he said, "Let the ladies depart." And he then proceeded to give us for about an hour a lecture on how we were to defend this country against invasion. And the three chiefs of staff were there, the foreign secretary was there, the secretary of the cabinet, you name it. And they all sat there as I did, like small boys. drinking in his words of wisdom.
Any details you remember of that?
Well, the only phrase I can remember was offensive defense. I mean, he didn't go down to the with the details of it at all. He was merely talking in terms of we must be prepared to not to sit back and be attacked, but to attack them as often as we can. And of course, the Home Guard had just by then been formed, etc., and was busy being armed, etc. So that was the first 2 months at, in the holding battalion. I then went back to London, where I did about a month in London, where I did a Queen's Guard, I should say a King's Guard in those days, where you went down in full the battle dress with fighting order, etc., and you marched from Regent's Park Barracks all the way down to Buckingham Palace, which was a long tab. And one also was on duty fire watching, and you had a 15-minute platoon, i.e. one platoon at 50 minutes notice to go out because they thought they might have airborne troops landing in Regent's Park or Hyde Park or whatever. And two more 30-minute platoons. I remember the fire watching. I was turfed out about three times to go and help fight fires down in the city. And one was far less frightened, although one probably should have been much more frightened, than sitting in the officer's mess trying to read the daily newspaper. Where you could hear these damn things, the Heinkel, like it was, had a funny sort of a noise, and you could hear the bloody thing up above you, and you were saying to yourself, I wonder if he's going to press the tip now. And one could do nothing about it, whereas when you were firefighting, of course, you were so busy trying to deal with the fires that you hadn't got time to be frightened.
How did you deal with them?
Well, we had merely water, in fact, stirrup pumps and sand. And of course, you were merely trying to keep the thing in check until the fire brigade arrived. One's main object was to spot the fire before it started, really, and to try and put the fire bomb out properly started.
Did central London look a terrible mess?
Well, after May the 10th, it did, yes. But by the time I got back there, which was, when did we get back? I got back, I suppose, about the end of May. I think we got back from our 2 months. No, it must have been after that, because I was still there when the Russians were invaded by the Germans, and that was June the 22nd. So I must have been in London in July. And then in August, I went down to Kenley Airfield, where we had a company there to guard the airfield. And we spent our time putting more and more and more barbed wire all the way around. And what was rather sad there, of course, was you used to go in to dinner in the evening, and one pilot that you knew quite well had gone. And they used to have a fund. Every pilot put in £5, and when he didn't come back, they spent the £5 on drink. Well, I mean, it was a very clean war for them, but it was a sort of a war where you were sitting in the officer's mess, you then scrambled, and you didn't come back again. Whereas with the army, you have a clean break, as it were, and you go to battle. And you have a beastly time, but at least you are not coming back again to the officer's mess. Well, then after that, I spent a very few days up at Harrow, where another company from the holding battalion was on standby to go to protect headquarters fighter command at Stanmore and North Holt Airfield if there was an invasion. I was posted to the 4th Battalion, which was part of the Guards Armoured, in early October 41, where I joined No. 3 Company. And we were then stationed just outside Frome in a large estate called Marston Bigot, of which the big house was the sort of battalion headquarters, etc. And we slept in huts which had been built, which were very cold and extremely damp, and our officers' mess was a gardener's cottage. And I did about 6 months with the Number 3 Company, and all I remember was endless exercises. The GOC of the division was Oliver Leith, and he was a brilliant trainer, and he worked at us. And at the end of every exercise, all the officers had to go to the largest local cinema, where he had a post-exercise wash-up. And he used to be frightfully rude to people.
What's that?
Well, I mean, I can remember once in front of the whole of, you know, all of us, about 500 people there, he said the divisional engineers did extremely poorly, and I require from the Commander Royal Engineers an explanation as to why it took him 12 hours to build a bridge over the River Avon. And the next day, the CRE had left. So obviously his explanation was not entirely satisfactory. But he was a ruthless man. But very, very, very good, I think. And, of course, went on and on upwards. Well, then in... Am I going on for too long?
No, please give as much detail.
Okay, right. Well, then I was appointed intelligence officer in about April 42. And we had endless exercises on Salisbury Plain, at least one every week, which lasted for 2 or 3 days. Well, I seem to remember that we were in fact a motor battalion in the 6th Guards Armoured Brigade. I seem to remember on all these exercises we did most of the work because the tanks couldn't be deployed until we got on a Salisbury Plain. So we were doing the advance guard through normal country. And then when we'd got a bridgehead on the plain, well, then the tanks came out and started to play ball. We then moved to from Marston Bigot in either be September or October 42 to Nook Camp Heytesbury. I should say, while we were at Marston Bigot, we did a ceremonial parade for King George VI at Warminster, where he came down to inspect us. And we also had a visit from Queen Mary, who arrived an hour early and caused great alarm and despondency. And she got out of her motor car, apparently. I only discovered this afterwards, because there wasn't anybody there to meet her, you see, because she'd arrived so early. And we walked over to what she thought was a hut and found a couple of guardsmen sitting on the loo and left pretty smartly. But we weren't at Heytesbury for frightfully long, because we were then told we were going to be converted into Churchill Tank Battalion, and we moved to Convent St. Mary down the road, where we were there for most of the winter, where everybody went off on courses all over the place. And I was left behind with the second in command and about three other officers to keep the guardsmen happy, while all the officers and NCOs went off to do D&M and wireless and gunnery courses.
D&M?
Driving and maintenance. We then moved to Leyburn in Yorkshire in April 43, where we trained like mad with the, because by then we'd left the Guards Armoured Division and were put under the command of 15th Scottish Division. And they came down to us and we trained all over the moors. And that went on all the way through the summer, and we moved down to the Dukeries, to Rufford Abbey near Ollerton, in October, November time, and we spent the winter there, where we did more training with 15 Scottish and also with 51 Highland. Division. We moved from Ollerton to Charing in Kent in April 44 and really spent our time there learning how to waterproof our tanks and all that sort of thing and buffing up before we were due to go abroad. I should mention, I don't know if Christopher Schofield told you this, the chief of the general staff, who was then Alan Brooke, was very worried about the shortage of guardsmen out in Italy, in the infantry battalions out there. And he issued an order that our brigade was to be disbanded and sent off to infantry reinforcements to Italy. Churchill discovered this and personally saved us. You'll find something about it in volume 4 of his 6-volume history, which I can turn up if you want to, where he writes a minute to the effect that it would be an absolute waste of good armor, as it were, to throw this outfit away. But of course, we were, before this situation occurred, part of 8th Corps. While it was being sorted out, we became army group troops, pushed right to the back. And so we didn't go abroad until July, we moved about the 17th to the 20th of July, 44, which was a great blessing in disguise because we missed all this terrible nonsense going on around Caen, etc., where lots of people had a bad introduction to war. And we were parked in an orchard for about a week. And I spent my time as intelligence officer going up and down the whole front, discovering from the four corps what was happening. And I was just in time to watch from a distance that terrible battle called Operation Goodwood, where we tried to break south from Caen. And it ended in us getting a bloody nose.
Can you describe what you saw?
Well, I saw it was the 11th Armoured who started the thing off, and they debouched from this one bridge where they were all trying to get three armoured formations over one bridge. And as soon as they got up onto the top of the hill, one saw the German 88 start to open up and tanks beginning to brew up. And that was not much fun at all. Fortunately, Monty decided to call the thing off before too much harm had occurred. But the Germans were very speedy to react because I think everybody thought that the Air Force, which came over in large numbers and bombed them, just before HR, as it were, would have made them keep their heads down, which they did to start with. But then, of course, as soon as the bombing stopped, up they got. But I, as I say, I went up and down the whole of the front and used to brief the officers in the officers' mess after dinner each night. We were very lucky in that we had our first action starting on the 30th of July, 44, breaking out from Caumont, and going south. Not only were we lucky because it was a breakout as opposed to a dogfight, as it were, in the area around Caen, but we also supported soldiers who we had trained with, and that is half the secret of success, because you know people, you can trust them, and you fight considerably better, I think, if you fight with people that you know well than if you fight with strangers. We certainly found that because we had to support four or five different lots of people during the campaign. And people who we'd never seen before, the thing didn't seem to work so well. Anyhow, the thing was a brilliant success, and Walter Bartlett, who was our commanding officer and our brigadier, deserve a lot of the credit, I think, because they decided at 4 p.m. when the infantry were held up, the only thing to do was to send the tanks up this very steep hill, which the Germans had thought are impassable to tanks. And I don't think any tank other than the Churchill, as it were, would have been able to get up there. But as it were, we did get up there. And the Germans were extremely surprised. One had to whip the infantry to get up, of course, before dark, otherwise we'd have been sitting ducks.
What was your role as intelligence officer during the battle?
My role was to interrogate any prisoners of war that we got. Not that they knew much or were much cop. I remember talking to one Italian medical orderly who roared and laughed and said, "Me go to England, you go further away." Ha 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 ha. Which annoyed me. But the other thing one had to do was to liaise with the infantry. And I was liaising with the Glasgow Highlanders when I was wounded on the morning of August the 1st, it would be, when the Germans put in a pretty sharp counterattack, which was beaten off. And I was hit by a shell in the headquarters of the Glasgow Highlanders, which killed most of them. And any person who escaped scot-free, I think, was the commanding officer. And I was very angry with him, that's how I seem to remember.
Whereabouts were you hit?
In the knee. And I didn't think much of it at the time. I mean, one felt a bit sick and one felt extremely thirsty. But I couldn't see much, and so I thought, well, I'll go on with this, you know. I went to their regimental aid post where they put a bandage on it. And I went on, I was wounded about 8 o'clock in the morning, I suppose. Went on till about 1:30, and then I don't remember much. I think I passed out. Next thing I remember was being taken back in a jeep back to Bayeux Hospital.
When you say the Glasgow Highlanders, do you mean the HLI?
No. These were some people who were a wartime organisation, 2nd Battalion, the Glasgow Highlanders. They were the TA battalion of the HLI, I think. Well, I was operated on that night, and they didn't take an x-ray, and they made a cock of it, and failed to find the bit. And I thought when I came to the next day, I was going to be back with the battalion quite quickly, and wrote a note to the commanding officer saying, "I hope to be back with you soon, being operated on." Next thing I knew, a nice nurse came and said, "You're going home to England." Well, I was parked for 24 hours on by airfield in a tent, virtually unattended, except to be given some food occasionally, by which time I had gangrene and a temperature of 105. So they flew me home, and I landed, I think it must have been at Bryce Norton, because we went to a hospital near Swindon. And I sat there for the rest of the day and was able to get a telephone call through to my parents saying, I'm home, I'm okay, don't worry. And then I was moved down to a hospital just outside Cardiff called Llanfloch Hospital, where they operated on me again and failed to do anything. No, sorry, they didn't. They decided that I needed to have a course of penicillin, which I had for 3 weeks, six times a day, as a result of which I'm now completely allergic to it. I have to say to everybody, don't give me any penicillin, please. They then operated.